Now let me just very briefly return back to this very nice geometrical picture, which I just summarized over here. So you know, what we've seen is that, you know, having any phase space function f whatsoever, this will generate the corresponding vector field, which is called Hamiltonian vector field. It will be very, very special. And by definition, it's given by this, you know, Poisson bracket, where you leave one slot open and you understand the resulting thing either as a differential operator or as a vector field in your phase space. But you know, once you have the vector field in the space space, then you can construct always the corresponding integral curves if the vector field is sufficiently smooth, and it has to be. So then you have the integral curves, and the integral curves are simply curves constructed such that the vector field is always tangent at any point of that curve, right? And so we suddenly have flows in our phase space, which are determined by this function f. We can parameterize these flows by the corresponding time coordinate, so tf. So you know, the value of tf will be something here, let's say 1. Later on, we will move to this point. Later on, we will move to that point, and so on. So this is just a parameter which parameterizes our trajectories in the phase space. Tf. Okay, so now you can write this identity here, which, as you will see in relativity when you discuss differential geometry, but it's sort of obvious, is that, you know, because we have integral curves and the vector is tangent, then this is actually just a derivative, total derivative, with respect to this parameter Tf. So that's what tangent vector means, and we know that if we have function f, and we consider df over dt, that will be a tangent vector by f. At that point, right? So this is precisely what you expect from the normal calculus, right? But then let's express what all these things mean, right? So we have the Poisson bracket definition. So it's just d over dq, df over dp, and so this one here. So this is just by definition the Poisson bracket expressing it. And then we express what the derivative with respect to time means, right? And so we differentiate with respect to q, and then differentiate q with respect to time, and you differentiate with respect to p. And differentiate p with respect to time. But of course, these two things, by definition and by construction, have to be equal. And they will be equal if what's standing in front of, you know, d over dq is the same as what's standing in front of d over dq here. And so we have one equation here. And then the same thing has to be true here. And so we have another equation here. And of course, you should be quite familiar with these equations, at least for the case when f equals to h. And so these will be precisely the canonical equations of Hamilton as we know it. And in that case, we call tf equal to f, tf equal to t here, right? So basically, you know, what you see is that the canonical equations really follow from this very nice geometric construction. And there is nothing mysterious about them. All right. So this is what I wanted to stress from the last time, which wasn't stressed, maybe. So let me move to a new topic, which will be constraints. And I'll try to do it as quickly as possible, as Mr. Bean says, flashes in flashes. So I will not give you any proofs or anything like that. I will just, you know, mess with your head. And I will give you lots of things to think about. But it will be okay. Very good. So constraints arise when not all the q's and p's as you see them are actually independent. So far we are considering the situation where really, you know, we chose independent coordinates, which there were that many coordinates as we had number of degrees of freedom. And if we chose more coordinates, I told you don't do that, right? We will have constraints. So this is the case now. We will have. Now, some q's will be not independent and some p's. So let not all q's and p's. And now we're mixing here Lagrangian and Hamiltonian picture, but I hope it will be okay. Be independent. Well, that means that what actually happens is that there exists a function, let's call it phi, which is a function of this q and p, which will be 0, just stressing that, you know, I have a dependent thing over here. And so this thing here is called constraint. Simplest example of a constraint or the pendulum. So if I consider pendulum, but instead of describing it in terms of the angle of phi, I describe it in terms of the Cartesian coordinates x and y. And so the constraint would be x squared plus y squared equals 2l squared, which I can, of course, write as x squared plus y squared minus l squared equals to 0. And that's an example of our constraint here. OK. And so we have these constraints. But of course, the constraint better be conserved in time. So better, you know, be valid for all times, right? So this is valid at any instant of time. So it is confusing and valuable at the same time to think about the constraint as sort of like an integral of motion, because it will be true. This thing here will be true for any instant of time. So it will sort of be preserved along your evolution, right? So you can think about it as a conserved quantity. But from Noether's theorem, we know that if we have conserved quantities, there must be symmetries. And so this will also, you can think about this, is that it also corresponds to some kind of symmetry. Corresponds to some kind of symmetry in the system. And we will see some explicit examples, you know, what these symmetries could be and what is the corresponding constraint and stuff like that. We will have a tutorial on this. So you will see an explicit simple example, you know, how this goes. Very good. So far, so good. So far, so easy. So now you can sort of distinguish, you know, fundamental different constraints are when phi is a function of q only. And so then you have really constraint on the coordinates only. And then you have a more complicated constraint where p's are involved as well. OK, so those which are functions of. So if phi is a function of qi only, so only qi, then these constraints are special and they are called holonomic constraints. So these are the constraints you might have encountered in your undergraduate studies. You probably have not seen the full constraints, which would have p as well. Okay, and so this is tricky. Sometimes you have a constraint which does depend on p or q dot or whatever, but sometimes you can integrate it and you can integrate out the time dependence on the q dot, and then you will end up still with phi of q, right? And so that will be computed equivalent constraint, and you would still call that constraint holonomic. So if you see if you see p there or q dot there, doesn't mean automatically that it's a more general constraint than a holonomic one. And it's actually very difficult to come up with examples where you have non-holonomic constraints, but you will see one in the tutorial. Okay. So anyway, so yeah.
Is it fair to say that holonomic constraints are equivalent somehow to visible symmetries and the ones that are more involved? Are hidden symmetries, or
I think you are not far away from probably the truth, but simply, you know, I would say that the holonomic constraints are stupid constraints, because you know you haven't really properly identified your degrees of freedom, let's say, and you chose your description, a really redundant description. I'm choosing more generalized coordinates than I need to, and then you know this type of constraint arises. But of course, you know, there are some good reasons why you should be doing that sometimes if you want, right? And so let me give you a canonical example of this. Yes.
Oh, so quick question before you do that. I just want to check. So the holonomic constraints on Q or also on P?
So you know, in general, the constraint looks like it's a function of Q and P as well.
Like, would would phi of just p sub I equal 0? Would that be whole?
Oh, that would, I don't know. It depends what you are doing. So again, from the Hamiltonian point of view, well, I don't know. Well, the question is, can you integrate it as a function of q only in that case? If you can, then it will still be holonomic. But you know, that's typically not the situation that arises. Typically, this situation arises when you obviously see just a function of q. Let me give you a canonical example. And of course, that would be the pendulum, which I mentioned here already many times. So pendulum. And sort of you have the clever description. Clever description which we are doing so far, which means that actually we know that the pendulum can actually only, you know, move by the angle, so there's only one true dynamical degree of freedom, which you can choose to be this angle phi, and so there's your pendulum which swings like that, and your degree of freedom is the angle phi, so we have n equal to 1 number of degrees of freedom, which is the angle phi. Correspondingly, your phase space will be two-dimensional. So then we have 2D phase space, which will, of course, consist of phi and the p phi, right? And of course, there are no constraints because we already eliminated the constraints. Okay, so that's the clever description which we were using so far. However, you can choose apparently stupid description of the constraint system. System description. And so in that case, this is still the same thing here. But now I use the Cartesian coordinates x and y to describe my system. Okay, so I'm using now Cartesian coordinates instead of the angle phi. But because I use Cartesian coordinates, well, it seems like I have 2 degrees of freedom, x and y. So m the 2 number of degrees of freedom. And the phase space will consist of, now phase space will be 4-dimensional. And it will consist of x, px, y, and py. But of course, we know that this is not entirely true. We still have a constraint. And the constraint is, if you know the length of the pendulum is L, then we have a constraint phi, which will be function only of x and y, and it will be that x squared plus y squared minus L squared equals to 0, right? So the length of the pendulum remains the same for all times. Right, it's a holonomic constraint. It depends only on x and y. It does not depend on px and py. Okay, so that's the other description, which seems much more complicated, right? It seems, well, I have twice as many degrees of freedom. I have to deal with the constraint and so on. So why the hell anybody would choose this description, right? So why? To choose a constraint description and basically in this case the reason is twofold. Well, first of all, you can always go from the constrained one to the non-constrained one by eliminating the constraint, right? So first of all, you know, still can eliminate the constraint, at least in this case, nicely. Well, that's not really a reason why to choose the constraint description, but anyway, eliminate constraint by, you know, eliminating the Cartesian coordinates in terms of the phi coordinate. So you could do x is L times cosine phi, and then y is L times sine phi, right? So I can still return back to my old description here by eliminating constraint, right? So that's not an advantage, really. But yes, it can be done, and, you know, we can go back. So the main reason why you should be doing this is that, well, you have a constraint, you have an extra symmetry, right, in the system. The symmetry is that the length of the pendulum remains the same. So this is very trivial here, but sometimes this extra symmetry can be super useful, right? And sometimes the extra symmetry allows you to do magic with the system, and, you know, then you can fix the symmetry or whatever, and then you suddenly solve the system, right? So the presence of this extra symmetry is many times very useful. So again, you know, an example of this extra symmetry where we would actually have to go to, you know, the full constraint will be the gauge symmetry of the electromagnetic field. So for example, if you describe your electromagnetism in terms of the four potential A mu, then you have obviously Lorentz invariant system. On the other hand, if you break the symmetry, you fix the gauge for A mu by saying, well, A0 is 0, AI is something else, right? So then you break the gauge symmetry of the system, but you immediately lose the Lorentz invariance as well, because the result does not mean that, well, it's not obvious that you have Lorentz invariance anymore for Maxwell. Right? So sometimes, you know, fixing the gauge or, you know, losing this extra symmetry costs you a lot. And for example, it costs you the fact that you immediately lose, you know, this apparent invariance of the Maxwell theory. It's still Lorentz invariant, but it's not seen from the equation. Right? It's very difficult to see. So sometimes this extra symmetry is super, super useful. So in our case of holonomic constraints, there is another reason which is quite down to earth reason. And the reason why to consider this description is that you can calculate constraint forces. And in our case, we know that if we have, you know, a point with mass m moving on this pendulum, there will be some force or tension, you know, that this force has to be compensated by the tension of the string, so that actually you hold the pendulum and it works, right? So for example, in our case, we could calculate the tension of the string needed for this actually to be happening, that the L remains fixed. So e.g. and calculate the tension of the string. So that our pendulum works. Okay, yes?
Yeah, so in case of the pendulum, what exactly is the symmetry? Because you told us that it was the fact that the length of the pendulum remains the same, but that is a conserved quantity, no? So what is the symmetry?
Okay, think about it. Yeah, well, it has to do with the fact that really, you know, that the length of the pendulum remains constant, right? So in this case, think about it. But it's a good question. All right, so now I'll give you a recipe how to deal with these constraints. Yes?
The cases in which that constraints, like taking into account the constraints, are very useful, are related always with local symmetries, or can you have global symmetries? Because the electromagnetic...
So the case I discussed, like in the case of electromagnetic, was a local symmetry, right? But I would say this is a global symmetry. Yeah, sometimes you can have global symmetry.
But here you said that it is not useful first.
I said that it's...
Like in the cases in which you get something else, like a force, you need the local symmetry, I imagine. But what else can you?
No. Okay. So here. Well, I'm not sure I understand the question, but the statement is it is sometimes useful to have this extra symmetry. And you know, one reason, for example, would be that I can calculate these constant forces. And this is the case when my symmetry, when I have holonomic constraints, right? So it only depends on Q and so on. And I would say it's like a global symmetry, right? So this is a global symmetry. I hope I'm saying something right. Let's see. Anyway, okay. So the recipe. How to deal with holonomic constraints and the recipe is sort of simple. But it's puzzling as well. But anyway, you will see in your tutorial that it works. I'm not proving anything here. So the first step is to actually consider, instead of the I'll be using the Lagrangian description. But instead of using the Lagrangian for the system, you use so-called total Lagrangian. So this will be a total Lagrangian. And this guy will be given by your old Lagrangian, or it has to be related somehow to that, plus minus. So imagine that we have more constraints than one. So let's say we have up to m constraints, okay? So then there will be sum over all possible constraints, j equal to 1 to m, or you know, all constraints. And these constraints are phi j. So these are our constraints. Okay. And then in addition to these constraints, there is this mysterious lambda j, which are functions of time. So, and these are called Lagrange multipliers. So lambda j is a function of time. Okay, so sort of introduce like new functions or whatever, lambda j, and they are functions of time. Yes.
Why wasn't phi j also a function of time? Couldn't it also be a function of time?
Oh, it could be also a function of time. Yeah. It could be. So it could be, you know, phi is like q and p, and an explicit function of time could be as well. Yeah. But then. Yeah, let me just deal with the simplest one, where phi is really a function of q only, right? So that's okay. So this is what you do, and then you just calculate. Okay, so very good. So we have this new total Lagrangian, and the question is, how do we understand this new total Lagrangian, and what do we need to do to define the right variational principle and so to solve our system and stuff like that? And the statement is very simple. So the total Lagrangian, well, the Lagrangian was a function of Qi, right? But the total Lagrangian, we now enlarge our configuration space, and we include the lambda j's as new trajectories or coordinates as well. Okay, so now we understand lambda t as a function of Qi, and that, but also lambda j. Okay, so this thing, let's say we have n degrees of freedom and coordinates Qi, and we added m constraints. So suddenly, you know, our configuration space is n plus one, n plus m dimensional. So n plus m dimensional configuration space. Okay. Very good. So we have this total Lagrangian depends on Q and lambda. And we enlarge the configuration space by including lambda as new trajectories or new coordinates over there. And so very good. So now we can vary our action with respect to both Q and lambda. So then delta S of t, okay, which is delta of L of t, dt. Okay, and then I can write it by, you know, from the definition, it's just delta L, and L and LT differ by the sum over lambda j phi j. I will not write the sum, as always. I'll just use the Einstein summation convention. So it's minus delta lambda j phi j minus lambda j delta phi j.
Capital M is the number of coordinates in the constraint system, right?
So N is the number of coordinates. So, you know, in our case, it'd be 2, right? And then lambda g is the number of constraints. In our case, it'd be just 1, okay? So we would have 1 constraint and 2 coordinates. Yes?
Is there a reason why we're assuming the original Lagrangian is not a function of p?
Okay. Very good. So the Lagrangian is a function of q and q dot, right? It's a function of q and q dot. So very good. So I should be, yeah, exactly right. I should be writing this. Let's not be sloppy. Let's just make it. Okay, let's leave this so that, you know, we can easily count n plus m, okay? But then also, of course, it is a function of qi, qi dot, and then lambda j, but there is no lambda j dot, right? So, and then, you know, possibly t, but you know. So this is what it should be. Right, so it's definitely a function of q and q dot, but it's also a function of lambda, but there's no lambdas dot. In fact, this is how we actually recognize a presence of the constraints, is that if you see some, you know, coordinates, lambda j, and you see that the Lagrangian sort of is independent of lambda j dot, then you know that actually lambda j are not true dynamical variables, but rather they will be Lagrange multipliers for your constraints.
So here, by adding the Lagrange multipliers to the and constructing the total Hamiltonian, you have assumed both that the phi is not a function of p,
yeah,
or t. And if it was a function of p, would this method work? Your L would be a function of q's and q lambdas, and as well as and you have to
so here it will be a, yeah so I would say, if you know, because I formulated in terms of qs and p's, we will deal with that in the Hamiltonian picture. So in that case, you know, your Hamiltonian is a function of q and p, and the phi is a function of q and p, and it can be dealt with, okay? And so I will mention very briefly how to do that, and we will just look at one example. But it's a complicated case, okay? So that case is more complicated. Okay, very good. So this is what it is. I just vary lambda as well. But now this variation over here, of course, L does not contain any lambda. So this will only be a variation with respect to Q, right? So this variation here will just give me the old Euler-Lagrange equations for L only. But I also have to consider the variations of lambda, which comes from this extra piece. Okay, so in other words, I can write this. Okay, let me write it, and then we can discuss what it means. So I can write this as dl t over d q dot, or d dq minus t over dt dl t over d q dot. Delta q dt, and then minus phi j delta lambda j dt. Okay, and then very many brackets here. Okay, so what I have done is that I have done the variation as respect to L, but L is independent of lambda. Okay, so I can, instead of writing delta L over delta Q, well, I can combine this term plus that term, that gives me that. But LT does not depend on, the phi's do not depend on Q dot. So I can write delta LT or delta LN, doesn't matter, right? So this term combines some of the terms here and this term here. And this term I can write either L or LT, doesn't matter, right? And then I still have this piece over here. Okay, so now if I require the action principle to be valid for my new LT, I conclude two things. I have arbitrary variations of Q, so this guy has to be zero. And then I have arbitrary variations of lambda, so this guy has to be zero. In other words, if you consider variational principle where you extend your Lagrangian to total Lagrangian, that's over there, then you are getting the standard Euler-Lagrange equations, standard Euler-Lagrange, but now for LT instead of L. Okay. So if you deal with constraints, you get the standard Euler-Lagrange equations, but now for the total Lagrangian instead of the old Lagrangian. But you also get that, you know, phi j are equal to zero, which are the original constraints. But now recovered from the variational principle, right? So we end up in the end with, well, there is an n equations like that. There's n equations because there's n number of q's here. So there's n of those. And we have m constraints, so m of those.
Sorry. Isn't the variation here done on q coordinates? So the definition of delta doesn't include delta t is equal to zero?
Delta. So this is the standard variation as in the equations of motion. So I'm not doing anything this time, right? I'm just varying with respect to coordinates. And I just said, well, I enlarge the number of coordinates, not only q's but also lambdas. So
the variation is with respect to the coordinates only, right?
So it's with respect to q and lambda.
Because yeah, that was my question: why delta lambda is not equal to zero?
Because I understand it as a new coordinate now. So the recipe is you take this Lagrangian and you enlarge your configuration space by including lambdas as well. Okay? So then of course I have to vary. So lambdas are just my new q's, right? So I have to vary with respect to both q and lambda. And these variations are independent, and this is what we get. So in the end, we ended up with n plus m equations of motion for unknown q, I, and lambda j, and there is n plus 1 of those. So in the end, you can solve everything happily, right? You have n plus m equations of motion for n plus m unknowns, q, I, and lambda. Yeah.
Is the Hamiltonian dynamics is also well defined in this?
So in case of holonomic constraints, there is no problem going to the Hamiltonian dynamics, and you can do it. Yes, you can do it.
Seems like the conjugate momentum of the Lagrange multiplier is zero.
So we will. Yeah. Okay. Very good. So I will. Okay. Maybe. You can, the statement is, you can do it at this Hamiltonian picture as well. The question is transition from the Lagrangian picture to the Hamiltonian picture well-defined? And I will discuss this case in a minute in a more general setting when you have non-holonomic constraints. Yeah, so sometimes precisely you cannot go from one picture to the other picture.
I think you've already said this, but the second partial of the total Lagrangian with respect to Q dots, that can be the Lagrangian because the like phis don't depend on q dots.
Mm-hmm.
But the first one you said has to be the total Lagrangian.
Oh, so what is DL T over DQ, right? So this is TL over DQ, right? But then I have also this thing over here. So it contains this piece here, right? And totally combined together, they give you LT instead of L, right? Lambda is independent variable, right? So if I do the LT over the DQ, I actually have to be doing like delta phi J, right? Yeah. So it's delta phi J over DQ and delta Q, and this is what's written here. Everybody happy so far? This is so simple, right? Yes.
Do we have boundary conditions for the constraints or the lambdas?
Well, you don't need to integrate by parts here, so I don't think you need any boundary conditions.
But if phi depends on q dot, then we have to.
We are not discussing this case, okay? We are just doing very simple things. Okay. There was another question?
Oh, no, I just went thumbs up.
Okay, thumbs up is good. Very good. So we almost done this case. Everything is super simple. You will see an explicit example how to do this for the pendulum. So the last thing which actually is useful to calculate the constraint forces and stuff like that is, let's see, you know, what we are getting out of this equation over here. Okay. So we have, you know, the equation, which is this one here. So we have d lt over du minus d over dt dlt over dq dot equals to zero. So that's our equation of motion for the total Lagrangian. And let's write it explicitly in terms of the old Lagrangian. Okay, so basically, I ask you to imagine it, but let's now expel it, expand it. So I should have done that earlier. Anyway, so this is dl over dq plus, or let me put it on the other side. Okay, minus lambda j d phi j over dq. That's what it is. And then we have the other term, and let's put it on the other side, d over dt, dl over dq dot, okay, plus zero. Okay, well, this is what it is. And so now let's have a look, what is the interpretation of this? So, we haven't really discussed what the interpretation of this dl over dq is, right? But typically, if you think about just, you know, free particle, which is, you know, q dot square minus the potential, then, you know, the kinetic term does not typically contribute to this thing. Sometimes it can, but you know, it's mostly the potential term which is, you know, which gives rise to dl over dq. So, for example, if you have particle in homogeneous gravitational field, where your potential is mgx or whatever, so this will just be mg, and it's like a gravitational force, right? Or similarly for the Kepler problem and stuff like that. So this thing can sometimes be given a physical interpretation of the force, right? So similarly, because this term is sort of the same nature, you expect that these terms should be like forces, right? But then, you know, imagine what these forces are. So let's say I have only one j, okay? So I have just df over dq times lambda. So now what is df over dq? So d phi over dq. So phi is my constraint. It's my surface by the constraint x, right? Now what you are taking here is sort of like a gradient of that phi, okay? So this will be a vector which is, well, let's put i's here. Now it's a gradient, right? So we have a gradient of phi, which is like normal to the surface of the constraint, right? And so this is a constraint force. Constraint force is something which is perpendicular to the constraint, right? So the constraint means that my my beat or whatever, it moves on a circle or something like that. And of course, the constraint force, which is, you know, the tension of the string preventing the beat to fall somewhere, right, is perpendicular to that circle. All right, so this is a constraint force. So these are constraint forces. That's the physical interpretation. And these are perpendicular to constraints. Right, so I can put it here. So if you have a constraint here, so our constraint for this thing here is like we have to move on this circle here, but of course the constraint force as constraint is perpendicular at any instant of the trajectory, right? So here it will be forcing like that, here it will be forcing like that, and so on. So this is the phi equal to zero surface. We have to stay on this surface all the time on the circle, and the constraint force is perpendicular because it's a gradient of phi, right? So that's what's going on here. So in other words, you can calculate these things here, and you can calculate, you know, how much tension of the string is really needed for your pendulum not to go anywhere, but for the length to remain the same. Okay. Yes.
You said on the partial, the total Lagrangian with respect to Q, sometimes can have momentum contributions, you said? You said there can be momentum contributions to that term?
I imagine, you know, your example yesterday, right, of the Kepler problem. So your kinetic energy part, right? So you had kinetic energy, which is x dot square plus y dot square plus z dot square, right? But So in that case, your kinetic energy does not depend on Qs. It only depends on Q dots, right? But if you change to spherical coordinates, and suddenly your kinetic energy will have some x dependence, right? R dependence and theta dependence. And so sometimes even the kinetic energy can sort of contribute to these things here. Right? That's what I'm saying. So it will be a force very vaguely, right? And this will be very vaguely constrained force. But in mechanical systems, simple mechanical systems, actually, you know, this works, and you can really, you know, it's some kind of constraint force, and you know, what is the precise interpretation is sometimes questionable. But for example, in the case of pendulum, it's super simple to show that it's really the force holding the beat on a circle, and you know, more general mechanical systems still be true, but yeah, it's not true. Okay, questions. Very good. So we delve with holonomic constraints. And you know, this is a very well understood procedure and so on. So now let's consider this is just a remark, okay? I am not developing the theory here. If you are interested, see Dirac's book. So everything is there discussed in the small book. Dirac wrote on constraints. Based on his, I don't know, four lectures he delivered somewhere. Okay, so let me do a remark on gauge constraints. And this is really to confuse you, okay? So whereas this is really standard, and you have probably seen this in the past, you might not have seen this thing here. And so imagine, you know, you want to, let's say, quantize gravity, right? So there's very many ways how to quantize things. One way is the covariant picture, where you do the path integral and so on, and you can, you know, stay in your Lagrangian description. And people were skeptical about that first, but you know, it's actually equally good as the Hamiltonian quantization, where you go first to the Hamiltonian picture, then you impose the canonical commutation relations and so on, and you know, quantize the system by you know, doing the Hamiltonian picture. But Dirac was one of the inventors of this, you know, Hamiltonian quantization. And so he was really interested, like, you know, can I quantize the system? So let's say I have a system where I know what the Lagrangian theory is, right? So then, in order to quantize it, I first have to go to the Hamiltonian picture and then impose the canonical quantization relations, and then I'll see what the quantum theory looks like. All right? So let's sort of go as a first step from Lagrangian description to the Hamiltonian one as a first step in quantizing our theory of Hamiltonian one. And for that, we knew that even at the classical level, the first step was to introduce the canonical momenta. We have the canonical momenta. I'm just repeating the second lecture or something like that. PL is DL over the Q dot. All right, so we define what the canonical momenta are. And then we just consider the Hamiltonian to be the EQ dot minus L, where we understand all the Q dots as a function of Q and P. All right, and in order to do that, we had to be able to invert this relation so that we can invert this relation and solve it for Q dot, right? So need inversion to really write this Q dot as a function of Q and P, right? And so if we can do that, then we can happily proceed to the Hamiltonian picture and continue our progress, right? But sometimes it happens that you cannot do that, and sometimes it happens that this inversion does not exist. Okay, so sometimes inversion cannot be done. And the condition for this is that some matrix where you differentiate this thing once more is degenerate. So this happens when d square l over d qi dot dqj, which is a matrix ij, is degenerate. So if you write down this matrix and you calculate the eigenvalues or something like that, you will find zeros in there. Yes.
When we're thinking about the inversion of that equation, that is a coordinate dependent situation, right? Is it possible to do some coordinate transformation so that?
So, I would say no. You're right that for a particular coordinate system, whether I can really solve for one q dot, it's a question of coordinates. You are absolutely right. However, this thing here is a matrix. Even if you change coordinates, the matrix will look like something else, right? But the fact whether you have the eigenvalues remain invariant, right? So the fact whether you have zero eigenvalues or not is coordinate independent, right? So sometimes this thing here is degenerate. And let's say we have m zero eigenvalues. Okay, and so that actually means that you have m constraints in your system. And what it also means is that your q dot I cannot be written only in terms of qj and pj. But it will also depend on arbitrary constants, arbitrary functions of time, and this will be your Lagrange multipliers. Okay. Yes.
A very basic question, but why are we eigenvalue multipliers? dependent on coordinates? Is it because they're scalars, so they don't transform?
Yeah, exactly. So basically, you can think about like change of coordinates, like doing some transformations on your matrix. But you know that, you know, the what are these transformations called? Anyway, so some similarity transformation. Well, anyway, you sandwich your matrix with some matrices, other matrices, right? But they don't do not change the eigenvalues as long as this is unitary or something like that. It's not the right word. Unitary is not right. But it's almost right, okay? So the eigenvalues do not change. Or at least the fact that whether you have zero eigenvalue or not, that definitely does not change. Right? Maybe if I rescale the matrix by 5, right, then eigenvalues will be 5 times bigger. But zero still remains zero. Okay, so even if you consider non-unitary or whatever transformation. Anyway, so the statement is this is an invariant statement. There will always be, you know, M0 eigenvalues no matter what you do. And then the best you can do is that you can write down your velocities in terms of these, you know, arbitrary functions, lambda j. Okay. So anyway, so how to deal with these systems. And the procedure is sort of similar, but very, very different from what we are doing here. So again, you define a total Hamiltonian which will be, well, okay. So we had a total Lagrangian, so now we will have total Hamiltonian. This piece didn't have any q dots in it, so it seemed like a potential term rather than the kinetic term. We know that if you go from Lagrangian, which is t minus v, to Hamiltonian, which is t plus v, there would be a plus instead of minus. Okay, that's fine. Here there is a plus. H plus summa over j, 1 to m, lambda j, phi j. And you know, these phi j are the constraints which now can depend on q and p as well. Okay? So this will be your total Hamiltonian, but now the total Hamiltonian, well, these are the constraints. You have a plus because you went to the Hamiltonian picture. Big J. But this will work for constraints with Q and P as well. Okay.
Excuse me, sir.
Yes.
We were working with polynomial constraints, right? So why will phi j be a function of pi?
Okay. Okay, so what do you, well, okay, so, you know, what's happening here, right? So let's say I start with the Lagrangian picture. I find that I cannot invert this thing. I cannot proceed to the Hamiltonian picture in a normal way. What it means is that, you know, well, this is inherently related to this fact that, you know, you cannot be inverted and it has to depends on some arbitrary function, whatever the inversion does. But, you know, what it means is that you have some constraints present in your system. Okay, so let's see, and there's a complicated procedure how you can identify what these constraints are. Okay, I'm not giving you that procedure. I'm just saying, well, okay, let's already know what the constraints are. Then how do I proceed further? And I proceed further such that, you know, I just consider the total Hamiltonian where I sum over the constraints. But these constraints can be more general than holonomic constraints. So in general, they will be more general, right? So they can depend on Q and P as well.
With the fact that we are basically from minus phi to we went to plus phi in case of Hamiltonian was dependent on the fact that phi j is a potential term, so it should not.
Okay, very good. I was saying I'm just motivating the plus here. I'm not really giving you. So, yeah, I shouldn't have said anything, right? It's a convention. You can do minus here if you want, right? But because the, you know, in case of holonomic constraints, in case where really phi is a function of q only, and if you start with that, you know, Lagrangian over there and, you know, the constraints, then there will be a plus here, right? But now I'm generalizing that. I'm saying these are just general constraints which, you know, can be identified. And there's a procedure for that, which is called Dirac's procedure. And you know, but what is important is that you know this these constraints need not be any longer functions of Q only, and they can depend on P as well. Okay, and they will for if you consider electromagnetic theory, you write down its Lagrangian formulation, and you want to proceed to Hamiltonian picture, you will pick up constraints which are functions of both Q and P. Okay. All right, so we have the Hamiltonian, and then of course we can write down the Hamilton's canonical equations and so on. But the question is, how do we now understand the total Hamiltonian? So before, what we did here is that we enlarged the configuration space, and we considered the total Lagrangian to be functions of Q and lambda as well. Okay, so that's what we were doing. So here, in general, this procedure will not work. If you have, you know, some nasty constraints. And what you need to do is actually not enlarge the phase space, but just keep it as it is. So it will still be a function of Q and P and only, but lambda J will be something external which is given to you. Okay, so in general, treat HT as function of Q and P, but you know, lambdas are just external things, external functions. Okay. So we are now not enlarging the configuration space. We just leave their lambdas as well, whatever they are, right? So we still have only n degrees of freedom, if you want. So only n degrees of freedom, but if you want 2n dimensional phase space. Okay, so that's a more general procedure than the one over there. Okay, very good. So then we can write down, you know, and solve, hopefully. Okay, after solving the Hamilton's canonical equations, for Q and P, well, we have our solution for Q and P. So we have only n degrees of freedom. We write down the canonical Hamilton canonical equations for these Qs and Ps only, and we solve them. But after we do that, of course, our solution Q will depend on, well, it's a function of Q0, P0, but it will also depend on the lambda, right? It will depend on the lambda and T, and P is that Q0 and P0 and lambda and T. Okay? Of course, well, we left the lambdas there. They are arbitrary functions. So our solution has to depend on these arbitrary functions. Okay. Is this solution useful? What do you think? So, you know, typically you want to know where the trajectory is, right? But what the trajectory is. But now I'm saying, well, the resulting trajectory depends on lambda, and lambda can be anything, right? So do I really know what the trajectory is? So in other words, you know, if you have your P and Q, and then you know you yourself say I use one lambda, okay? I choose one lambda, and I start at Q0 and P0. And then I choose, I know this is fixed lambda, and then at some time later I end up here, okay? So for my choice of lambda, and then your friend says, well, I don't like that lambda of yours, I'll choose a different lambda, okay? So then they, you know, write down the solution and they end up here. And your third friend chooses a different lambda and they end up there. Okay, so you have, you know, your final solution Q and P, which depends on, you know, time and Q0 and P0, but it also depends on the choice of lambda. So this is, you know, lambda dependent, and then solution. Okay. And the question is this unuseful? Right? So can these friends ever agree on, you know, where the particle is after, you know, some time evolution? One claims this is my solution, the other claims this is my solution. And can they agree on that? Right? But remember that I said, well, introducing these constraints, it's like, you know, writing additional integrals of motion, and there should be a corresponding symmetry. Okay? So the statement is that these solutions are not completely arbitrary. So you get four different lambdas, you get different solutions, but all these solutions are related by the symmetry of the problem, the symmetry of constraint. Symmetry corresponding to the constraint. So you have two possibilities. One possibility is, well, I fix the symmetry at the beginning. I eliminate the constraint, I have fixed the symmetry. And of course, that means I'm fixing lambda. If I fix lambda, then everybody will agree where the particle is. Everybody will end up in the same point. Or you don't fix the symmetry, the gauge symmetry. You actually leave it there, right? Then everybody gets a different solution. But the truth is that the solutions are not actually different. They are still the same solution. They are just related by this gauge symmetry, which you have in the system. Okay, so even here, statement is that physics is unique. So really, you know, whatever the lambda you choose, it doesn't matter. It still gives you the right physical description. But the description we have chosen, is not. And so, you know, the final endpoints. I'm writing the same thing already, related by symmetry. And okay, so that's all good. The last thing is actually to tell well, how do your friends actually agree on the physical prediction of the theory? Right? What do they need to do? So that actually, well, one friend says, well, my particle is here. The other friend says, no, my particle is there. Right? How do they agree on where the particle is? So how to agree on the result? And that's so how to decode the unique description. Description. And you will think about that in your tutorial, and the right kind of questions you should be asking are so-called relational questions. I will not tell you what they are, I will let you meditate what this could be, but the aim is really, can these two friends ever agree on where the particle is, right? And each of the friends are using different lambda, right? And so, yes.
How did you write the total Hamiltonian? Because for the total Lagrangian, we knew the form of L, which was a function of QI, QI dot. And yeah, that's basically it. And so we knew that we could replace it in the equation and solve for the equations of motion with the extra values. But here you said that H cannot be derived because the L dot cannot be inverted. So the total Hamiltonian is still.
Yeah. As I said, there is a procedure how to do this. I'm not giving you that procedure. You will see one explicit example how this is done. And Yeah, let me maybe discuss a little bit of example, because this all seems very mysterious, right? Okay, very good. So I thought, well, okay, let's discuss it a little bit. But you're right, this is highly non-trivial, right? So let me just give you a few hints for your tutorial. So in your tutorial example, and I'm giving you the answers, right, for the tutorial. So it will be super simple for you then. So what you'll be doing in your tutorial is considering a motion of the free particle, but from a point of view of two observers. One observer will be using the inertial time, okay, and the other observer will have broken clock. And they will be measuring the things in terms of their broken clock. I know the broken clock can go, you know, twice as fast as the initial time, or you know it can get arbitrary with respect to the initial time, right? So we will consider a free particle from a perspective. Of observer with broken clock. I'm sure it happened to you as well. For example, you go swimming in the sea, you forget that you have your watches on, right? And you know the sea salt is not very good for your clock, for your watches. So then, you know, then after you swim, your watches go arbitrarily, basically, right? So of observer with broken or lousy clock. Well, what does it mean is that time of this observer will be basically an arbitrary function of the initial time. Okay. So very good. So that's the setup which you will consider. So first, what you will do is that you will write down the Lagrangian of free particle. Okay, in terms of capital T, in terms of the initial time. And then you will change capital T to small t. I'm just reparametrizing my trajectory, if you want, an arbitrary clock. Okay. So then you have your Lagrangian written in terms of small t, and then you try to do the Legendre transformation to the Hamiltonian. Okay, and so what you will find, interestingly, if I just very naively do the Legendre transformation, you will find that that the Hamiltonian is equal to zero. Okay. By naive Legendre transformation. So, by naive Legendre transformation, you will see that. Well, we basically killed time evolution by introducing an arbitrary time parameter. Well, that makes sense, right? So, because our clock doesn't mean anything, the clock goes arbitrarily, there cannot be any time evolution, right? Very good. So we find that h is equal to zero, but of course the total Hamiltonian will not be, because there will be a constraint. So there is a constraint which again can be discovered, you know, by doing some Dirac's procedure, but you will just observe that, you know, there will be a constraint like this. P plus px square over 2m equals to 0. I'm not sure if I'm not messing this, whether it shouldn't be small t, but let's see. We will see in your tutorial. So your Hamiltonian will be non-trivial, and so there will be ht is non-trivial. And it generates the flow of the time evolution. There will be a corresponding flow of time evolution. But your total Hamiltonian is the old one, which is zero, plus lambda times phi. So, you know, the solution of this time evolution will depend on this lambda. Okay, and so question is, you will have precisely the situation here. So you will have, you know, endpoints. You know, one person using 12 o'clock will say, well, the particle is here in my 5 o'clock. The other one, in my 5 o'clock, the particle is there. How do they agree on what's going to happen? Okay, and so you can start meditate already how to solve this issue. But we will have a tutorial on this. Yes? Yeah, I think it should be probably small pt. But anyway, so you know, you have coordinates. You will see. So you know, what we are doing is that we are enlarging the configuration space first. So in order to introduce this new time parametrization, what you will be now understanding is that your Lagrangian is not function of x only. And then you have px in the phase space. But also, we will be promoting time to be independent variable of some, you know, lousy clock, small t, or something like that. So now you'll have two variables, x of small t and capital T of small t, right? And so then, correspondingly, you have two momenta, px and p capital T. So this is correct. OK? And so you'll find that ht is non-trivial. Anyway, yes?
When we're talking about the inversion of the equation, you said because if it's impossible to invert, it will depend on some arbitrary functions lambda. I don't exactly see how that is justified.
You can just check that, right? So if you know, if you see that, well, you can explicitly construct that.
Okay. The way I understand constraints and like Lagrange coefficients is that we want to solve an optimization problem by like. Making these lambdas externals of a curve, like lambda cannot be anything, it should be the external of a curve. So I think it may solve the problem, like lambda is not really a continuous curve of it. We should like solve it for our Hamiltonian in a way that like optimize lambda, and like this is a constraint, it's a Lagrange equation solving, like it's a differential equation. Like I don't see how lambda can be anything, as you said. Like,
It cannot be anything in the first case. So you are really solving for lambda in the first case, right? So you're just treating it as a new coordinate, and you can solve for it. You will know what lambda is precisely.
The question is, we want to solve the equation of motion with a constraint. It means that it's just solving the equation with constraints, which is just, we need to like differentiate in terms of lambda, and then we can solve for lambda like precisely.
I don't think it can be done every time. But certainly what is true is that, yes, you can do it your way sometimes. But the other way is that you don't do it. You are not solving for lambda. You are just solving for Q and P. So that's like an alternative way, if you want. So either I solve for Q and P and lambda in the first way, and I have that many equations, so I can solve it. Or I am not solving for lambda. I can leave the lambda there as independent. I am not having it as a new dynamical variable or whatever. But of course, then my solution depends on lambda. Now the question is this a disaster? Well, it's not a disaster, because I can still agree on predictions of the theory, even if I have arbitrary lambda. OK, so.
Writing Hamiltonian this way is then meaningless. Like, we're writing it this way to like optimizing lambda. The only like writing Lagrangian with constraints on that way, like, you know.
It's not meaningless. It's
really introducing a new potential. It's just solving the some constraints. Then it means that we should do it like the proper way.
Yeah. So the answer is it cannot be always done as you are saying. But I don't know it on top of my hand, like why it cannot be done. But the statement is it has to do with what types of constraints you have. And if you have constraints which are general, which are non-holonomic, then it cannot actually be done. Okay. So it's for simple holonomic constraints, you have two options. I can go this way or I can go that way. For non-holonomic constraints, it's not so easy. Okay?
The real question is why we allow to treat lambda in this way, that, you know, like a new degree of freedom, because it is not.
Oh, it exactly. Here, I don't treat it as a new degree of freedom.
Yeah, even in the Lagrangian picture. But here, you also is still treating lambda as a, like, as a variable that can be anything, and it can be like a continuous function, something like that.
Yes. The answer is yes, I am treating it like that. Okay, one last thing which I wanted to mention, this thing here, although we will see it in the case of the free particle, the fact that Hamiltonian is equal to zero after you go to, you know, the Hamiltonian picture is a traditional feature of totally constrained systems. Constrained systems, and it will not be true, for example, for electromagnetism, but it will be true for gravity. So if you go to the Hamiltonian picture of gravitational field, you will find that the Hamiltonian basically is equal to zero, and it's only sum over the constraints. So it's only the constraints which matter for gravity.
I still don't know why we wrote the total Hamiltonian.
I didn't tell you why, right? I'm just writing it.
We said H is impossible to be retrieved from the equations, and now so we add Lagrange multipliers to that H that we don't have to make it more complicated with the lambda that we don't have.
Exactly. So you know, so again, because I'm cheating here. So what really happens is that, you know, the procedure, the DAC procedure, not only tells you how to do the constraints, but it tells you how to find the right Hamiltonian, right? What is true is that the true Hamiltonian will typically look like I have like some naive Hamiltonian, which you would have, plus some constraints, right? But the procedure immediately gives you, well, it doesn't split into H and phi, it just gives you the total Hamiltonian immediately, right? So there's a procedure how to recover HT. Right, and the fact that I can split it into this thing or that thing doesn't, you know, so you know, maybe I shouldn't have. Well, anyway, so you know, the procedure gives you what HT is. Okay, so it doesn't, you know, you are right. H I cannot probably define, or I can define it very naively or whatever. And you know, question is how to do that, right? But the procedure, the direct procedure, gives you what the constraints are, and it gives you what the HT is, and that's all you need to know.
From HT, find H. Couldn't you just do the procedure in reverse and find P's? And so basically, you are inverting the LDQ dot. So if you're able to find H, wouldn't you automatically be able to find the inversion of the LDQ dot?
Well, in our case, H will be zero. So not really. Okay, let me stop here. This is where I really, you know, to give you some hints for the tutorial, and you will see a lot of fun. But why you are doing that tutorial is that you will finally, after you understand this tutorial, you will know how to quantize gravity, okay? You will know how to do this for gravitational field, and you will know everything. I still have 5 minutes, which is not much, but it's good. The last thing I wanted to discuss about the Hamiltonian dynamics was integrable systems. And I will at least give you the theorem, which is useful, and you can you know, use it to classify your systems into integrable ones and non-integrable ones. Okay, so I'll just give you the Liouville's theorem. It's the same guy as we have seen the Liouville's theorem about the volume of the phase space, but it's a different theorem, okay? And you, next week, you will have Minu, who will, you know, basically start from where I ended on integrability. And she will discuss, you know, what complete integrability means in more detail. And she will also tell you what happens if the system is not integrable, when you have chaotic systems and stuff like that. They will have some very brief introduction into chaos and so on. So it was FG was integrable systems. And let me just state you, so the definition, you will call a system with n degrees of freedom is completely integrable. Or integrable in the liberal sense, but okay, completely integrable. If it admits m functionally independent integrals of motion, AI. Oh, the fact that they are integrals of motion means that the Poisson bracket with h is equal to 0, right? Or all ai 1 to n. But this is not enough. So for n degrees of freedom, you need n integrals of motion. But that's not enough that you know, we have n of those. But they have to be in involution that are in involution and what that means is that all of these constants of motion or integrals of motions, they have to pass on commute mutually, okay, so such that EI IJ equals to 0 for all IJ to 1 to n, okay. So that's a definition of what you will call a system integrable, completely integrable, if this is the case. Well, that's great. We have a definition. So is this definition useful? And the statement is it is because of this Liouville theorem. So there is a theorem due to Liouville statement is that the solution of equations of motion of completely integrable systems, can be obtained and now for a word a quadrature by a quadrature, which is basically an operation where you do some algebraic operations and integrations, so which is like finite number of algebraic operations and integrations. Okay, so that's the theorem. So in other words, if you have completely integrable system, you can actually integrate it up to doing some integral or algebraic operation. Okay, not every system will be like that. In fact, many of the systems you will see actually are chaotic systems. And they will not be completely integrable. They will not have these integrals of motion. And then they are chaotic. So this is a beautiful concept of complete integrability, which is true in Hamiltonian dynamics. If you go to quantum theory, everything gets much more complicated. And you know, if you ask Pedro what he means by complete integrability, he will start talking about the S matrices and about the scattering in quantum mechanics. And he was saying, well, your theory is completely integrable if the scattering of, you know, very many particles can always be decomposed into scattering of two particles at one point, and then another two particles, and so on, and so on. So there will be an integrability for Pedro, but this is an integrability of, you know, of the Hamiltonian dynamics. Yes? The question? No? No. Very good. So we have complete integrable systems, and really you need all these integrals of motion so that, and they have to be in motion so that your system is integrable. So now you can read the outline of the proof in the lecture notes. But why is the outline of the proof is interesting is that the proof is actually really nice to go through. And the reason is it's constructive. It really tells you how to integrate your system. And basically, the proof goes as follows. Of course, we are in Hamiltonian mechanics. We want to find the proper canonical transformations so then I can solve my equations of motion. Right? And in order to find the proper canonical transformations, you better find the corresponding generating function. Okay? And the generating function is given by one integral, which you have to do. So actually, in order to integrate your system, you have to do that integral for the generating function. Once you have the generating function, you can transform to coordinate system which you like, and then you can solve your equations of motion. Okay? So constructive, and it's basically like one integration, for generating function, for special generating function. And then from there, once you have the generating function, you do some differentiations and you do some algebraic operation. And then algebraic operation. And so really, you can see how to integrate any system which has this property that the integrals of motion are independent and in evolution. So we now know what involution means. It means this. Okay, this is very important for the proof, because if this were not true, the integral for the generating function wouldn't be well defined. Okay, so basically what you have to make sure is that the integral is defined from one point in the phase space to another point in the phase space. And the question is, if I go on this trajectory to that point, or if I go on that trajectory, I better get the same result here. Okay, and this is precisely guaranteed by the fact that these integrals of motion commute. Okay, so this is important. If this is not true, then your generating function is not well defined, and the whole procedure breaks down. Okay, the second remark is, well, I said that these integrals of motion have to be independent. What did I say? Independent integrals of motion. Well, you can think about that as, you know, you have I1 equals to constant. Okay, so that's one of the integrals. Well, what is this equation here? It's an equation for a hypersurface in your phase space, right? So it's I1 is a function of Q and P. It's equal to constant, some constant. So I can do. So I have a constraint I1 minus the value I1. Right? And so that's equal to zero. So this is the value of that integral. And that defines a hypersurface in my phase space. Right? So let me just draw one last picture here. I'm over time again. Sorry for all this. So this is your P. There is some Q. There is some other variables. You have more P's and more Q's and so on. So, you know, I1 equal to I1 defines a hypersurface in your phase space, right? Then I have another integral of motion, I2 equal to I2. There will be another hypersurface. The independence means that these hypersurfaces do not coincide, that they actually intersect, and they never sort of be aligned with one with another. So the statement is that I will have another hypersurface here, I2 equals to I2. Of course, my motion happens where I2 is equal to I2 and I2. So it has to happen in the intersection of the two surfaces. And the independence mean of these integrals of motion tendence means that the hypersurfaces, are never tangent. Because otherwise it wouldn't restrict the dimension where my motion can happen. So here, each hypersurfaces reduces the dimension where the actual motion can happen by one. Right? So if I am on this hypersurface, I have to move in that hypersurface. I cannot go off that hypersurface. And similarly here, I cannot go off this one. So I have to move in the intersection of the two. Right? And then I have a third one. So again, I have to be in the intersection of the third one and these two. Right? So each integral of motion has to reduce the dimensionality of your motion by one. And if that is true, then these integrals of motion are independent. If it does not reduce, if they are tangent, right? If they are tangent, then it doesn't reduce by one, and then I'm screwed up. So independence means all these hypersurfaces are orthogonal. Very good. So we will have we now understand what complete integrable systems are, and you will see next week what chaotic systems are. Okay. Questions? Yes.
Independent. They're just tangent, like...
At a single point.
Is there a double point?
It may happen that there are some degeneracies of these hypersurfaces, and it will happen in general. And you would still have integrable systems, but not at those points, right? So you would the systems will be integrable anywhere else, but you would have to exclude these points, right? So what chaos is? Is that if you have integrable system and you perturb it a little bit, then actually you preserve some part of its integrability, but not all of that. That's the content of the KAM theorem, and you will discuss that next week. Okay? Very good. We will start Maxwell's theory tomorrow. Happy times.